We have this community announcement from Jobs with Justice and other organizations. Today they are asking you to support immigrant and human rights from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. in front of the Mexican consulate in Portland at 1305 Southwest 12th Street. Bring banners and signs if possible. This action is in opposition to the anti-immigrant group Oregonians for Immigration Reform. That group plans to protest in front of the consulate today in favor of deporting all unaccompanied children and single parents who have come into the U.S. in need of refuge.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. Amidst the chaos and destruction that's going on in the world, this is Joe Uris taking the place, nobody can replace, but stepping in for Positively Revolting. This is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. This is Friday. The number to call, 231-8187. My name's Joe Uris, and I want to actually talk about something else. And you can join me, and we can have a conversation. I want to talk about the Founding Fathers' conception in the Constitution of the United States. I want to talk about what exactly that is and how I believe it limited and circumscribed the possibility of a true democracy, and how now, under the leadership of a very revanchist right wing, we are seeing we are discovering just how limited our freedoms are going to be in the near future. And I must admit, I'm a little despair filled, so maybe you can cheer me up. I really like to be cheered up, but I also like to tell the truth. So here's the deal, and I'll just start with this. When the Constitution of the United States was created, it was created initially so that trade between the states could be more efficiently done, and so the states wouldn't function as separate nations charging tariffs and fees for transporting goods across state borders. And the big struggle of that time was exactly what the powers of the states would be vis-a-vis the national government. And the decision of the Founding Fathers, most of which was, you know, really closed to the public in general, was to create a republic and eventually a bicameral legislative system, a House of Representatives, which would be the people's house, as it were, a Senate, and, of course, an executive branch of government, and much less considered the question of the third element of government, that is the judiciary, which became more powerful not as a consequence of the Constitution directly, but of the assertive powers effectively rendered by the Supreme Court. Okay, so first of all, real power legislatively under the Constitution initially was limited to the Senate. Now, most of you probably know, but it's really important to understand that until around 1900 being a significant year of change in the progressive movement, members of the Senate were not elected by the people of each state, but rather were chosen by state legislatures. State legislatures were really dominated by politically powerful elements within each state. So, in terms of lawmaking, in terms of real power, the Senate was crucial, and the Senate was not of, by, and for the people. That's very important. Also, remember, the presidency was carefully limited through the process of the Electoral College. That was a very deliberate effort to keep a direct popular election of the President of the United States under wraps, under control. But also, understand what the Constitution does do four or two people. The only people who can vote under the initial constitutional rules were property-holding white males. Women could not vote. African Americans could not vote. And, of course, this enshrined slavery in many, many ways. Native Americans could not vote. This is really important because what it says essentially is that property holders, people with wealth, remember property was the major way you measured wealth at that time, the property holders were the only people who had a vested interest adequate to warrant their being able to participate in the process. And again, remember that the Senate of the United States was not directly elected by the people, that in fact each senator, the two senators for each state, were chosen by the state legislatures. And that wasn't changed until the turn of the 20th century. So with that in mind, with that understanding that we need to have, we need to look at what's going on right now in the United States and what path the country seems to be taking. I believe very strongly that we have put into power through the Supreme Court, which has become more and more aggressive over time, we have put into power essentially five men, all of whom are white, all of whom have conservative religious views, all of whom are conservatives in other ways. And we are in a pattern now of moving away from democracy in the small d sense and into a kind of imperialist pattern built around traditions that are post-World War II, that are basically Cold War ideas. And we have a president who has not shown the strength to be either a liberal or a progressive in opposing that. For a variety of reasons, I think part of it has to do with his go-along, get-along nature, but I also think that we have a Congress that is so difficult to deal with that the presidency is virtually tied up, disempowered in the process of that. So that's the context of what's going on in the United States, in the world. Meanwhile, and this is really important, the world moves forward, the world moves on. China advances. Even India advances. And when I say even India advances, it's because I want to make sure we all understand exactly what the situation of these countries are. China, which at one time had a dream of a, I wouldn't call it democracy, but a dream of a kind of socialist nation state, huge nation state, has essentially abandoned all of that egalitarian politics in favor of a basically capitalist model, forcing people out of farms, out of small houses, into large apartment houses, into huge cities, forcing people into an industrial nation state that rapidly grows and is very, very successful in the economic sense. For the ordinary person, there's other issues, but for the state of China, the question is resolved. China has become a very great power. Meanwhile, China has asserted its right, which it insists on, to explore for oil in areas that were or are considered traditionally the waters of Vietnam, the Philippines, Japan, and so on. The response in the West has been to create a counterforce, rearming Japan, for example, as one of the major players in the war potential of this situation. So that's going on there. The United States holds a lot of responsibility for a lot of the bad things that are happening. If you look at the current crisis with immigration, with these young people, these children really, coming to the United States desperately out of Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador and so on, they're coming here because staying where they are is untenable. It's dangerous. It's literally dangerous. You die. You join a gang or you die. The Zeta cartel dominates much of the region's politics. But most important to understand is that beginning with the Arbenz government in 1954 in Guatemala, the United States has regularly manipulated or directly controlled the governments of the countries of Central America. Now, that was not new in 54, but it became very notable at that time because it was a post-war move to attempt to stop what was perceived as part of the advancement of a communist megaforce. In the process of that, a kind of military junta system developed in the region, which continues to dominate. Every time a struggle is made to create a more democratic system, the United States engaged in subterfuge, in terrorism, in a variety of maneuvers to produce a government which would be not only friendly to the United States, but as it turns out, pretty ugly, pretty vicious, pretty murderous, and in the drug business. So we have this huge flow of drugs in the United States, demand here being the significant force in that. And at the same time, we have a situation where livability for ordinary people in these countries became virtually impossible. So they make this deadly or nearly deadly trek to the United States, and they show up. And this gives an opportunity, a huge opportunity, to a kind of right-wing, racist, know-nothing politics, Tea Party politics, basically, to oppose the entry of these kids into the United States. So one know-nothing policy piled on top of another know-nothing policy, leading to a situation where the United States does not take the poor, the tired, the whatever, teeming masses. No, no, they're no longer welcome here. So that's going on. Meanwhile, as I said earlier, we have a constitutional system which was built on and improved over the years in terms of its democratic potential, but built on the power of the wealthy class. And now we have a Supreme Court which has decided essentially that money equals personhood and that corporations are people and that corporations, in fact, can decide who their employees can, what kind of health care employees can have based on some kind of religious belief or other. And this is the situation we're in. At the same time that all that's going on, all hell has broken loose in a variety of locations, and the United States is not effectively in a position, nor should it be really, to deal with any of that. So I lay all that out to you. I really want to hear from people with their ideas about what, and this is going to sound like, oh, good old Lenin, what is to be done? What can be done given the limits of power in the United States? My personal belief about this country is that it will continue in a long, slippery slope toward, I guess I would call it, and I have used this term before, friendly fascism, a system that accommodates commercial desires of most Americans while leaving those same populations in relative poverty, while a very elite, a tiny elite of 1% of the 1% at the top control everything and own most of everything. That's what I think is happening. And this is nothing to do with old ideas out of Marxism that suggests that somehow there can be a social revolution to produce a proletarian government, a government of the people, that will in some manner, in a very, I think, totalitarian model, end up creating paradoxically democracy. So I'm looking at all this, I'm thinking about all that, and I wonder how you, our audience out here, are responding to this, how you see things going, where you think things are going, and what, to quote Lenin again, is to be done about what's going on. The number to call is 231-8187. I'm hoping a lot of you will give us a call with your imaginative or straightforward ideas about how to proceed in America and how to deal with the situation we're in. I come to you kind of empty-handed with this because I don't think there is any easy solution to any of it. On the other hand, there is hope. There are very interesting people in Congress, both in the Senate and in the House, who are fighting for the rights of Americans and who are fighting the vast machine of the Koch brothers and others whose money is essentially more and more a dominant force in American politics. So that's where we're at. And I want to know what your thinking is. Here's the question. So let me put them straightforward. How do we create or return to, depending on how you think of it, a democratic, with a small d, society? How do we build a base of real freedom and of real democracy and real participation in the political process in the United States. That's number one. Number two, how can we accomplish, without a revolution, a reasonable redistribution of wealth so that there is a strong consumer base that will support an economy of the size of the United States and will leave people relatively debt-free? All of these questions hinge on an understanding of the role of the banking community, of the role of power, of the role of the vastly wealthy in the American historic and current situation. And I'm at a loss. I look around. I see that the creation of problems by the United States in its past has led to further reactions. Again, I cite the example of all these kids coming north because it's untenable to live where they are born in places like Honduras or Guatemala or El Salvador. And I see a huge movement of nativist, and that's the old term for it, nativist attitudes, which oppose persons whose skin color is not white, whose first language is not English, and whose values are not seen as being synonymous with the kind of New England, the essential New England and Midwestern notions of what it is to be an American. So, here we are in the middle of all of this, and I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking about it, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are, because, locally, amazingly, there is a strong left community, but it is overwhelmingly shouted down by a kind of business-as-usual attitude. And I look at the so-called political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, and I see in the Republicans a strong movement to the right, really a proto-fascist movement, and I see in the Democrats a kind of weak loss of fundamental value. And I see also a Supreme Court that has enormous power now, and it is reversing all of the gains of the civil rights movement, of the women's movement, of so many other things that have made America, in my lifetime, seem more democratic, more fair, more open for all Americans. So, what do you think? 231-8187. Mark, you're on the air.
Joe.
Hey.
Thanks for your passion and for your truth-telling. Have you heard of the website
next new deal okay
.net. The people are too big to fail. That was proclaimed on a poster that you can see on that website. You can read Joseph Stiglitz's articles. He spoke to the Senate, tried to explain to them how inequality hurts. Very powerful.
Yeah, now I want to just tell people, they may not know this, I think they probably do though. Joe Stiglitz is a Nobel Prize laureate and a very brilliant economist, and he appears occasionally on shows like the Amy Goodman Show.
I don't know how many of the senators were awake,
Expecting senators to be awake is always a mistake.
They're part of the Millionaires Club, and they're pretty infatuated with the material wonders,
Yeah.
So that was one main point, that we focus people on the next new deal as our theme, and a corrective to the right wing attacks. I'm very upset by investor protection trade agreements.
Because those are coming up and going to be more and more common.
And they really undermine the constitutional state.
Mm-hmm.
They create a parallel system of justice, of three-person arbitration courts. And they really threaten the public sector, the social environmental laws, anything that can reduce profits.
I agree with you. I think that's what's happening.
The fracking moratorium in Quebec is being challenged, being sued. The minimum wages in Egypt are challenged and sued by a French company that owns a waste disposal company. So it's really vital for people to to understand these trade agreements. It's amazing how the media and the elites just simply repress the realities. Also, the desperate need for affordable housing should be a priority and not a convention hotel.
Right.
And so once the government takes some positive steps, progressive steps, then they will regain their voice, and people will be enthusiastic again. The public spirit will return when the Social Security cap is removed and everyone pays into Social Security, so it's secure for 75 years. I don't think you have to be a rocket scientist to understand this. You just need some principle, you know, and some love for the future.
Well, I agree with you, and I think that one of the things I don't understand is how this tiny ruling class sees itself as not endangered by the same forces that they are producing that endanger the rest of us. It's as if there's a kind of a magic protection. I guess they think they can get on their yachts and drift around on the increasing seas and be okay or something.
Yes, the elites live in a self-immunized world.
Yeah.
And where they never make mistakes. Everything is just a learning experience, you know.
That's an interesting way of putting it.
Hillary actually has convinced herself that the invasions were acts of liberation for women, which is a dreadful...
Which invasions are you referring to?
The invasion of Afghanistan.
Oh, right. Well, ironic. I mean, there's an irony in all of that.
Yeah.
Which, of course, has to do... When you're in a global world where customs are oppressive, extremely oppressive to half of the population or more than half of the population, there are many ways to go. One of the ways to go, of course, is to withdraw from that, from participating in that process at all. Another way to go would be to engage in wars of liberation somehow as a non-imperialist power. That's extremely unlikely. The excuse that somehow we would liberate the women of Afghanistan is not a realistic expectation given the cultural background, given the deep cultural biases, and given the control that men have in that society, in that basically tribal society. Anyway, I agree with all you've said, and I really appreciate your comments. I want to give some others an opportunity.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the call. I'm taking it easy today. It's tempting to express the deep moral outrage that I feel over the attack on Gaza. It's tempting to talk about the disaster we put ourselves in the Crimea and in what are called the blood, or called the bloodlands, of Middle and Eastern Europe. But I really think that the key to understanding the dilemma of the United States today rests more with a set of desires expressed by the founding fathers that there be control of the United States by white men. The continuance of slavery, which after all went on until it was pushed to the point of the brink of no return in the face of industrial development and in the face of a world which more and more was repelled by slavery. And after the Civil War, of course, there was within the South an enormously successful effort to repress and force into essentially slavery position all of the African American community. And the Civil Rights Movement was the effort to regain the rights that were guaranteed under the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. But all of that is now endangered by a notion of the legitimacy of monopoly capital and other forms of large capital holding, as if those corporations were in fact people with the same rights as you or I. And this is a decision made by a very small number of individuals in a Supreme Court that has been essentially appointed by a series of appointments from basically right-wing presidents of the United States. So we're in a kind of a weird dilemma. Meanwhile, in the international sphere, the President of the United States wants to punish the Russians for their role in essentially the whole of the Eastern European situation. And that makes no real sense. And at the same time, the U.S. has one firm and absolute ally in the Middle East, and that's Israel. And apparently we will not deny Israel anything in the course of all this. And there's a linkage, an unfortunate linkage in all of this between politics, as we in the United States understand it, and political slash religious beliefs. So the notion of a war between Sunni and Shia, which we made possible by smashing the regimes of people like Saddam Hussein, becomes a crucial factor, a terrible crucial factor in a horrible situation. And the struggle between Zionists who attempted to build initially a socialist nation state in the heartland of Palestine, taking the position to the American people, which I've talked about before, that nobody was living there, or at least nobody that counted was living there. So all of that is taking place in the context of a huge influx in America of desperate refugees, most of them children, and the reaction to that has been a real horrific right-wing racist reaction. So all the worst elements that have never been in and of themselves resolved in our cultural fights are continuing on. And I look at all this, and I look at it in terms of the founding of the country, and I think, what is to be done? And I turn it to you. I want to hear your ideas. I want to hear your hopes, your dreams, and perhaps your agony around all of these issues. The number to call, 231-8187. I take a deep breath here, and I'm thinking about all this, and my sense of the historic moment we're in is that it could be a very bad turning point. We have had a disappointing liberal with a little L president in Barack Obama, which shouldn't have surprised us, and maybe is even, to some extent, a consequence of a racist assumption that an African-American man would, by his nature, be both more liberal and more left-wing than a counterpart who was a European-American. I think that was a dramatic assumption of falsehood. Obama gave brilliant speeches. He presented himself. He was cool. His family was cool. It was a cool thing. He presented himself as offering a new possibility and new opportunities, but very quickly became mired in the same old games and did nothing to control the power of the elites. And of course, we have a Congress that is in such deep reaction that all of the things that should have happened beginning in 08, all the things that were necessary to rebuild the economy in the manner of the New Deal could not be implemented. Though I have to say, in Obama's favor, much of those ideas were put forward by his government. Well, we're in that situation now where not any great solution has come up for the economic crisis of the past, and we're still looking at the injustices produced by that system. We still have people out of their homes, underwater with their mortgages. We still have a society in which many, many people are unemployed or underemployed. We still see the American labor movement more and more destroyed, disassembled, and essentially disempowered. So there really is no counter force of significant power that is organized either as a political party or as an economic force. Maybe Occupy was the last such thing, to challenge the growing force and power of an enormously and very wickedly ambitious ruling class. This is a either proto-feudalist or friendly fascist phenomenon. And we all know it. And I think our way of dealing with it individually, maybe we'll engage in some political struggle. Maybe we'll try to change things. But I think most of us hunker down, hope to find some kind of a job that will give us a living wage, hope to build our families, hope to build our lives, fight hard for individual freedoms that are important. We see some advancement in the struggle for equal rights and so on for gays and lesbians. That's good. We see some efforts that make things better, but at the same time, overwhelmingly in the sphere of economics and in the sphere of militarism, the United States moves inexorably toward a position of isolation and toward a position in which it attempts to dominate the world through the use of its military power. And I wonder what you all think about that. Do you have any ideas for the future? Any way to challenge all of this? 231-8187. Here I pause, looking into the silent bliss of radio silence, and wait for your calls. Do we have any hope? Do we have any ideas? Do we have any new or old or traditional ways of looking at these issues? We're getting some calls. Whoa, that one was not there. I'm a little bit piqued, a little bit upset, because I feel like so many things, and I can't use the word that I would like to use for them, are going down now so rapidly in a situation in which there is such a lack of leadership. I'll give you an example that comes to my mind. I remember John Kerry standing in front of Congress and being a Vietnam War vet, rejecting the war, saying, who's to be the last, I think the words were, I'm going to paraphrase it, last man to die for a mistake. Well, that same guy who objected to that war is now running from nation to nation, pushing similar errors in the interests of the United States. His ambition, originally to be president and now as Secretary of State, seems unabated. His wealth, his situation make him essentially an establishment figure. He came out of a background which would predict that, and here we see that happening. I turn to the Justice Department and see very little effort to control the power of monopoly capital. I look at the automobile industry and I see that we have gotten to the point where our largest auto company, which is partially owned by the United States government, that is General Motors, has been producing cars that are deadly for a long, long time, and has hidden the fact, and nobody's going to go to the jail. And the same is true for the banking community that led so many people to disaster with their mortgages. Nobody's going to jail. And there's no consequence to any of this. What's the risk? You might lose some money. That's the risk. And it's incredible to me that we see the rise of monopoly capital in every sphere of life, including, amazingly, in the area of healthcare for women, and women's ability to decide their own reproductive lives. Pretty amazing and pretty sad. So all of this is going on, and I'm looking at it and thinking, I feel like a little kid wanting to cry. I want to hear you tell me to cheer up. I would like to hear your ideas about what can be done, what should be done, and what will perhaps be done. Because just because I'm in a dark mood doesn't mean you have to be. Just because I see history as all bad doesn't mean you have to see it that way. So let's hear from you. 231-8187. Okay, well, I'm going to read this. What? Wait, we've got Linda? Hi, Linda. Hello? Hello? No hello? Okay, Eric.
Hey, Joe.
Hey, man.
Hey.
Cheer me up.
Wake up and be happy.
Okay.
This is Eric from MDC.
How are ya?
Pretty good. Haven't talked to you for a long time.
It's been a while.
I'm in a little scrape with Portland State University, the powers that be there. Put me on the street two years ago. They locked me out of my dorm room after I paid the rent to finish my bachelor in molecular biology, and I've been in homeless ever since, just until 3 weeks ago.
Wow. I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, the thing is, it's not, I'm sure it's happening all over. Apparently universities think they're exempt from landlord-tenant law. And I'm going into arbitration with them next Monday.
Really?
Yes.
Well, I wish you luck with that. It seems to me that, you know, now remember that I have been in my life involved with Portland State in a number of roles, including as a professor there, and I've seen the schools as a very much in my mind like City University of New York, CCNY. It's a place for ordinary folks to work their way up to other kinds of, to professional lives. And I've seen a transition now where the school has become more and more, putting more and more emphasis essentially on technology as the future of it. And where I see the idea of a liberal arts education being kind of put in the back, just destroyed very quietly.
Well, they're going the same direction that OHSU is. They're becoming a public corporation to get out from the staffing requirements of a teaching hospital.
Uh-huh.
And back in 98 when that happened, OHSU was told by University of Oregon, it was their medical school, that they didn't want anything to do with them. And now Portland State, Oregon State, and University of Oregon are all doing the same thing.
Yeah, actually, I think they're each going to have their own separate boards as part of the plan.
Correct.
Yeah, anyway, I wish you luck with that arbitration thing.
Well, I'll keep you apprised of that.
And, yeah, let me know what goes on there. My sense of things in general in the university structure, particularly the public university structure, is not very good. That is that what is being the pressure from the business community is to produce people who can do certain kinds of tasks, but aren't necessarily going to be people who will question the tasks themselves. Anyway, good luck, and let us know what happens.
I will.
All right, thanks a lot, man.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, do we have anybody to call her right now? Maya.
Maya, yes.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, I don't know where to start. I'm just as frustrated as you are.
Yes.
But you know, I came to America right after the war in 1949 with my family, and my parents thought it would be a good idea to come here.
Mm-hmm.
Because my father was in the military, and he was assigned. He actually was a guerrilla fighter, so is my mom, fighting for the same ideals of democracy and all of America. You know, my mom loved America
mm-hmm.
because they're so progressive. So, you know, these kids remind me of me. And I think, go back is all I can say. What kind of government is it that they have that's so oppressive? And it's nothing new. It's just like that all over the world. Yeah, you know, the way that I see it.
Mm-hmm.
And so here in America, though, because it's such a light of hope for the world, I'm wondering if we are defined by a word named, called democracy,
mm-hmm.
whether we should not redefine, and I don't know what you want to call it, you know, you get caught up in words like Webster says, we redefine your world. And I look at that because I speak, you know, a different language. I'm from a different culture, and I think differently just because of where I came from, but not so much as better. But, you know, there's so many people. We are now actually, you know, no longer American white. And a lot of these people have in their hearts that, yeah, democracy can work because they, you know, never had it. I watched my parents as guerrillas fighting for, you know, freedom from oppression.
Mm-hmm.
So people basically just want to have, you know, live, you know, have enough to eat. They want a good home so that they can have shelter. It's the basics, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, we are really like the Native Americans when the Europeans came. All of a sudden, their freedom is gone. The way of life and their resources are taken away, so they can't take care of themselves. And you know, not here, right here in Oregon, so happy. Died because of a broken heart from you know, not being able to live his way of life. You know?
Yes. Well, you know, you raise the situation of Native Americans into our consciousness, and the degree, not just the injustice, the abstract injustice of it all, but the possibilities for other ways of doing things, for other ways of governance and other ways of organizing society were simply disappeared. And,
exactly, and correct. And the Iroquois tribe, I think, maybe was the one that was taken for example.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well,
like,
it said that the
got like all these things in my head, and I said, no, we don't have to settle for this. For one thing, we have a tax system mm-hmm. where people who are working, the slaves that we are in McDonald's and all of that, you know, we have a right to say, you know, where our money goes. We have a, you know, and the hope here that we're asking for is, you know, I thought, you know, how come there's no black men in the White House? You know, you go through the back door, a black person. And here, Jesse Jackson ran, and I supported that. Then Obama, and, you know, that was heart, you know, rendered. That was, like, beautiful because we spoke out. You know, we don't want the same thing again. And, there's the hope that we can do the same thing again. The people who voted and was behind Obama have actually a lot, probably, I think, even people that I've talked to, my friends, have said, oh, you know, and they created this doubt in their mind. But, you know, they're expecting that mentality to be the same for people of color. Mm. You know, I can speak of in 1949 in Atlanta, Georgia, when I found out that my, skin that's not white is colored, because we were asked to go sit in the back of the bus. And they were, you know the story. What if I,
sure, sure.
Because, you know, the thing is, we've come a long way. A lot of things happen. We're progressive. The technology can work. However, you know, African children going to the mine for pieces of metal that you need in your cell phone, right? We don't think about our own power as individuals and looking at what we do to create a system in our own life. Well, I don't like the word system, but that's all I have.
Yeah, I see where you're going with this. I also want to give some more people an opportunity, and I need to read some promotional material here. So I'm gonna let you go, and I'm gonna continue on.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
But I appreciate your comments. I really do. All right. Let me just say this. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Veterans Voice, Marvin, Bill, and Angie speak with Scott Olison, a Gulf War veteran who was seriously injured by Oakland police during an Occupy rally. You remember this guy? I think he got hit in the head with a shell from a tear gas shell and was really hurt. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, a report from the ground in Gaza from a hospital under heavy Israeli attack, and an interview with Detroiters resisting emergency management. And you know what's happened to Detroit. It was handed over to, essentially, to the banks, to Monopoly Capital, to manage the city and to take away the democracy of the city itself. And at 11, on Radio Zine, local activist Rachel Townsend and her husband, Danny Cavado, who was from Honduras, talk about the situation in Honduras and how it relates to the children coming to the U.S. fleeing violence in their home countries. And I hope that they'll be talking about how the United States overthrew the governments, the Democratic government, most recent Democratic government in Honduras, and how this led in turn to a dominance by various vicious gangs, including the major drug cartel, the Zetas. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one right now. Go to KBOO FM and click on Donate Today. I really, really hope that you will support this station, because we are the only progressive voice in the Portland media market. And I want to remind you, we're talking about, I'm opening with the question of what the founding fathers, there were no founding mothers, built in the U.S. Constitution, what their intention was. Basically, my argument is that their intention was to maintain power in a more efficient way for both the merchant class and the the merchant and banking class and the slaveholding plantation class, and that this continued on until the Civil War. And after the Civil War, essentially there was the argument for and the establishment of a subservient working class. The union movement and the great struggles that came out of other periods of time post-Civil War seem to now have been checked and balanced, and more than balanced, by the rise of an incredibly powerful, incredibly wealthy 1% of 1% that dominate American policy domestically and in terms of other nations, and that there is, in fact, a culture of reaction becoming more and more significant in the United States, even though all the data we have shows that the American people, by and large, have liberal beliefs, liberal ideas, and are scientifically minded rather than religiously minded. I want to hear from you. 231-8187. What's going on? Do we have Diana?
Yes.
Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you for your show, Joe. I really appreciate your requesting people to bring in hope. I don't have much, and I appreciate your analysis. It strikes true to me. The one ray of hope, which I heard this morning on Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! Show, is it's double-edged, of course, but it is a ray, and that is, I think Sharifa Dokadus was talking about the actual social media impact, you know, average Palestinians under attack constantly, able to Twitter or tweet or, you know, send instant messages to people so that what is actually going on there is not filtered through the corporate media. And
well, that is hopeful. In fact, I want you to stay on. I just want to make one quick comment. There is truth to the fact that it is possible that technologies may overwhelm the control by the capitalist overclass. Go ahead.
That's my point. And I obviously, you know, we know all of our cell phones are tapped, and the information is going into giant troves, being trolled through by trolls, if you will.
I like that. Trolled through by trolls.
But I'm hopeful that, you know, the more people have access to, you know, my basic smartphone, which, it, you know, I'm one step above a Luddite, and so, you know, this is puts a burden on more technologically capable people to be the people who say, this is what's going on. We know what's going on. We're the people who are democracy with a small d, and that's the way that any change has ever been made. We are in an overwhelmingly oppressive circumstance, but if people in Gaza, where the oppression is beyond belief, the open-air prison there, can get out at least some of what's going on there, and that gets spread to the rest of the world, then certainly, you know, us with our first world problems can manage to do that as well, and keep doing our best to overwhelm the corporate media. And, you know, with a moribund Congress, I don't have much hope for that, but I do believe that the local organizations, the smaller efforts to bring improvement to local economies, to create locally conscious, locally chosen economic endeavors, and to attempt to organize working people and unemployed people, all of these things, you know, that's small d. That's the only way we're ever going to make any progress. And granted, it is, you know, David and Goliath and then some. And it does seem to me to be the ray of hope that that I hear you asking for, that I'm always looking for.
Well, and I really appreciate your call. And I'm going to give some others an opportunity, and I'm going to make a few comments. But thank you very much.
Thank you, and we've got to keep KBOO going and honest, and it's, you know, again, it's a double-edged sword. There's always more, it has to be critical support. It has to be support, and it has to be critical support to keep it representing who the people are.
Thank you very much for the call. All right, I'm thinking a lot about these issues, obviously, and I make a point every now and then, and I want to make it again. One cannot know where the tipping point historically is. One cannot know when it will happen that people decide enough is enough and turn to another alternative. Now, despite that, let's look at some of the other things that are going on in the world. In France, for example, right now there is a virtually rudderless government. The Socialist Party there is largely discredited. The right wing is insurgent and resurgent and becoming very, very powerful. A mood against foreigners is growing throughout France. A similar attitude exists in Germany. The United States has displayed an incredible stupidity in spying on the German government. So there's a breaking up of that alliance. Is that a good thing or a bad thing for us? That is the people of the U.S. We shall see. Meanwhile, there is an increasing sense in this country of right-wing righteousness that is getting way too much media coverage and is being treated way too much as if it were a legitimate political thought. When you see things like what happened in Murrieta in California, when you see the idiocy of all of that, you become, at least if you're a person like me, a bit despair-filled because it makes no sense. And yet, we are a nation that forgets that it is a nation of nations. We forget that we are a nation of immigrants. Unless you're a Native American, you're here because you came here or your family came here. And you were coming here probably for economic advantage and or freedom. And both of those are really at risk right now. The average income in the United States has gone down. The job opportunities, the economic mobility for the majority of Americans has never been lower since the 1920s. All of this is happening in the context of a continued American imperialist endeavor. We still are engaged in and now sinking ever deeper into a mire in the Middle East at so many levels. Our one reliable ally is engaging in a murderous war in Gaza. Our previous sort of allies in the region are engaging in their own civil wars. It's a bad situation. And there is no sign of a good, either liberal or left-wing perspective coming out of the leadership of the United States, with a few exceptions. I think we have Jeff Merkley here, a decent senator. I think we have decent representation generally in this state. I think we can be thankful for that. I see in Elizabeth Warren some hope. I see in a variety of figures the possibility for real improvement and for a growth of progressive thought. But I don't see that is going to be able to counter the vast power legitimized by the Supreme Court and basically designed, I think, to restore the original constitutional notion of government of, by, and for the wealthy white men. I want to hear from you. 231-8187. Helen, you're on the air.
Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Well, it's just totally overwhelming, and we're just talking about absolutely everything, and so I can only add a few crumbs of my own. And one was yesterday I went out shopping, and I was so depressed, and I thought, you know, why am I so depressed? I don't understand. And then I'm driving home, and then I heard the plane crash, and suddenly I wasn't depressed anymore. And it was like the idea that it was coming, you know, it was going to happen. The atmosphere was telling me that this was going to happen. And it was a shock, but I do believe that, things prepare for ahead of time for something to happen. And sometimes I wonder how many people think about those things, or if they had a good day yesterday or not have a good day yesterday, because I think it was difficult. The other thing, I just cry out for somebody to, you know, take care of the world like a huge father of the whole world and say, shame on everybody for the behavior, and let's stop this war. And the sad part of it is there's nobody that can do that.
Well, I understand what you're saying. And now you put me in the odd position of pointing out that there really are movements and struggles going on, that there are, that they're underreported because the media is in the hands of the same people that are manipulating everything else in the economic and political sphere. But that actually a lot of people are aware, a lot of people are trying very hard to make things better. And I am not willing to give up on the possibility of a greater democracy for the United States. So, you know, you made me get positive.
Right. But the other thing is, I think that what's coming is still, I think a lot of people are going through a lot of things, a lot of sorrow, a lot of death, even in, you know, individual lives, and that we have to go through these lessons or these difficulties to come out to have a new way of thinking and believing. And I do think it's going to become more difficult. And I think after a while already, the earth is speaking. And if we're not listening, it's going to shake us to the bones to say, you know, you can't have your way. I mean, just look in the East Coast. So I guess that's what I have to say.
Well, thank you, Helen. Thank you for the call. And I have to say she has a valid point. There is no question but that the planet, which I don't believe has a consciousness, but which does have a response to the physical universe, the planet is, in essence, in a situation where we will face global change. We will face climate change. We will face rising seas. All of these issues will require us as human beings to either unite and work for solutions or fall by the wayside and some other bizarre creature. Maybe cockroaches will become the new intellectual leaders of the planet. I don't know. Anyway, that's a silly idea, but you get the idea. 231-8187. Linda, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
You asked earlier what is to be done. I'm echoing the famous statement from Lenin in his famous book or paper, however you want to talk about it. And I don't know if you're recalling the answer, but the answer that he gave was create public opinion, seize power.
Mm.
And I think that actually the imperialists learned that far better than we did. Look who controls the majority of the media, the majority of the ears get voices that are from the imperialist-owned and, you know, controlled media. And so I think it's, you know, I actually think there's a lot to that. Now, I'm not saying, I mean, that's what cable is. That's what you're doing. That's what you're doing on the air right now, what Joe's doing and what everybody who calls in. And there's also a famous activist that David Barsamian likes to quote, who has a really famous poem, and I don't have it in front of me, but the essential thing is you have your voice, speak. And so, you know, I mean, I think that we're losing the battle of creating public opinion. They have the largest majority. They have TV, which makes a huge difference in terms of just the unconscious penetration of certain values into people's lives, whether they think about them or not. And people like to say advertising doesn't affect me, but that's been clearly proven differently. So I think Lenin was on to something there. I think all of those who support independent media and see how much a difference it makes are on to something there. And it has to go way farther. There are reasons they clamped down on the Snowdens. There's reasons that they just today on Democracy Now, we heard about him polling a reporter who just was honest. So the battle over public opinion isn't really totally lost, but I would say they're winning, and we need to take it up big. We need to take it up bigger. I don't know what that will result in, but without it, we will not. We have no.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you, and I think that we, again, what I said earlier is true. We don't know. We never know the turning point historically because we just don't have enough information. It's possible that even as I speak in despair, things are happening, changes are taking place that are going to build a new world. Certainly, the objective reality of the planet itself will force changes. And I want to thank you for the call.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I guess we're out of time. Is that not so? Okay, well, we don't have a closing theme song today. Oh, yes, we do.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Pop Now 2014. From Friday, July 18th until Sunday, July 20th, PDX Pop Now will host bands on two stages, celebrating and supporting all ages music in the city of Portland with bands such as The Bugs, The Portland Cello Project, The Estranged, Purse Candy, Orchestra Pacific Tropical, Summer Cannibals, and many more. PDX Pop will take place at Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Avenue in Portland. More information about PDX Pop Now 2014 can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland, your community radio. Coming up at 9 o'clock right now, next, in Veterans Voice, Marvin, Bill, and Angie speak with Scott Olson, a Gulf War veteran who was seriously injured by Oakland police during an Occupy rally. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. And at 10:15 on Flashpoints, a report from the ground in Gaza from a hospital under heavy Israeli attack. And Thomas Stevens of Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management talks about poor people, water, and the move to privatize the water system. And the Biggs Beat has commentary on gay white men appropriating black